theology and exorcism in the Pittsburgh Diocese. He's an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists based in Rome. Over the past decade, he's helped educate priests regarding exorcism at national conferences, seminars, and through consultation on many cases in a number of dioceses. He's assisted at many dozens of solemn exorcisms, house exorcisms, and resolutions of hauntings. In addition to church cases, he reaches out to educate people on the current paranormal craze, the dangers therein, and ethical ways to resolve hauntings. He's put together a pastoral manual for priests on exorcism and resolving human spirit hauntings. Today, we'll be talking about his book from Emmaus Road Publishing entitled Hauntings, Possessions, and Exorcisms. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you.
Well, first off, to start the conversation, I think I want to stress this topic is first and foremost a very serious topic. Spiritual warfare is a big deal, and the situations you deal with are, quite frankly, a bit scary for some to talk about. Can you tell us to start with what this world you find yourself a part of is all about?
Well, I'd say really the bulk of what it's about is about catechesis. You know, the root of all these problems, as scary as it can seem to be from watching the movies, which is where most people get educated on it, really it comes down to free will choices and the choices we make and what spirits we enter into relationships with. So, you know, that's the core of the cases, the drama of the exorcisms and, you know, the things people associate with spiritual warfare and you know, all the ego stuff and the dramatic stuff and the loudness, all that is really secondary. The core is the person's choice about a first commandment issue, and that's the core of demonic problems. So, you know, that's really where most of the energy, I think, is. I mean, yes, there is the other drama once a person has made a choice to break a relationship with the demon. There is, you know, a period of prayer, and there's some work to be done there, but I would not focus on that part of it, you know, for the public, because the useful thing to get educated about is how the problems are entered into by people so we can avoid them.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. And I'm going to ask you a question you're often asked, and you stated this in your book. But I think, and you probably realize it was going to be asked anyway, but why did you choose to do this? How did you choose to get involved in this field you're in?
Well, I was kind of drawn into it. Initially, I was interested from more of a psychological perspective because I was working on a PhD in adult clinical psych and doing brainwave research. And I had seen that the brain can produce false experiences. Both from mental illness, but also from hypnosis and shifts in consciousness, half-dreaming states, all of this. So I was curious whether the paranormal phenomenon that was just becoming popularized at the time, this was more than 10 years ago, was real or not. So that's kind of how it started, was a curiosity. But then what I found was, after I first off found that it, in fact, is a real spiritual phenomenon, and it has an objective reality. It's not just a subjective experience of the people. Once I found that out, at the same time, I found out that there's only a few people working in this area. It's increased dramatically since then, but then there was a few priests working in this area. They were isolated. They were generally alone. There was little support, little understanding. People either feared what they were doing or dismissed it. And so that was kind of the impetus. Once I realized it was real, there was also this sad situation where the world, even within the church, didn't really believe in this stuff or kind of believed in it and was afraid of it. And so there was, there was kind of a sad dynamic going on there. So that was the impetus in getting involved in conferences. You know, so we did our first one kind of with that intention of starting to build a community here in the States where, you know, priests could come together, some of the people that work with them, and have kind of a community and a little bit of support. So those were the kind of the two layers. One was it started as curiosity, but then I was drawn deeper and deeper into it. And then, you know, also God had to have had a hand in it. I'm not saying that I'm special in any way, but it's not normal for a lay person to be as involved as I am. And it's not, it doesn't make any sense for a lay person to be training in priests in an area that can only be done by priests. But what happened was, you know, I met the main key people in the States at the time and went to so many exorcisms and had a knack for understanding what was going on. And just through friendships and relationships, things grew and I became one of the people involved in this area. So it's that part of it I can't really explain. I just have to accept that God wants it done because the bishops asked me to do things. And that's kind of by definition, you know, if the church is asking you to do it, you do it.
Right, right. So that's an interesting story. Now, early in the book, you talk about the spiritual world being legalistic, that it's bound by a set of rules. Can you explain that a bit for those of us who've not read this book yet?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, if we look at the Bible, if we look at life, there's rules and there's rules in society. There's rules that we live by, things we don't do, things that we do that we maybe don't want to, like paying taxes. You know, it's part of life. And in the spiritual, it's the same way. You know, God created order, and part of that order is the rules that spirits operate by. And a big part of what the devil wants is for you just to see a movie or some, you know, some other depiction or description and have this idea that he's this chaotic, crazy serial killer running down the street. And if you bump into him and you're just unlucky, you'll end up possessed or destroyed by him. And it's not that way at all. He's a very limited creature. He's on a leash, and God has a leash. You know, it's just like in the book of Job. It's a very, very accurate description. If you read that in the Bible, he has to go to God and ask for permission for everything that he does. So when you start understanding that, the exorcisms become less scary and less dramatic and more of boiling it down to, you know, what's really going on here? How did this person consent to you being here? And helping the person renounce those things. And then once all that's done, the demon comes out quite easily. So the rules are there. Understanding them takes away the fear and also empowers you to guide the person to be free.
That's a very interesting thing you said there, and actually leads right into my next question. How do you discern when you're dealing with an actual possession or something more in tune to mental illness?
Well, of course, it's case by case, but down through the centuries, the church has identified a few signs of possession that even back in 1614, they had figured out that there are certain signs that go beyond what people can normally do, you know, in the context of mental illness. So, for instance, the classic signs that are talked about in the ritual, one of them is facility with any language. You know, the focus is languages the person doesn't know. So schizophrenia doesn't make you fluent in Latin or Aramaic or Hebrew if you don't know those languages. Mental illness doesn't make you fluent in those things. One of the other signs is knowledge of hidden things that the person couldn't possibly know. So in the movies, this is always the secret sins of somebody in the room where the, you know, the demon says, oh, you think you should be here today, but, you know, we saw you last summer when you did such and such. It's usually not done that way, but they will demonstrate knowledge of things that the actual person would have no way of knowing, and it's very specific. It's not vague. That also can't be accounted for by mental illness. Another one of the signs is detecting the holy. So in some form or reacting to the holy. Now, if you hold up a crucifix and a person cringes, that's obviously not a sign of anything, because psychologically if I'm pretending to be possessed, of course I'm going to cringe at a crucifix.
Right.
But, you know, we may have a relic in our pocket, you know, a first-class relic, because we use a lot of relics, mm-hmm. and we haven't told anybody we have that relic with us, but the demon will pipe up and say, oh, so-and-so is here, and we'll name the saint. Hmm. Just an interesting side note, they'll use the nickname of the saint from their religious order. They won't give them the respect of using their proper name, but they'll use the nickname that saint goes by. You know, so these are some of the signs where mental illness can account for that. So the other thing that's important, and I don't mean to be long-winded about it, but it's a huge question, is it's not always either or. So if you were being possessed and tormented and sleep deprived and plagued by nightmares and physically attacked for years, you would be anxious and depressed.
Right.
And that would be a natural reaction to that. Like, imagine a battered spouse, you know, in an abusive relationship, and they've been in it for years. They're going to be depressed and anxious and hypervigilant. And that's natural. It's a natural reaction to that bad situation. Well, a possessed person, by the time they ask for help, has usually been possessed for years. So, you know, to say, oh, you're depressed, therefore, you know, we can't pray for you. You have to be a little more subtle and discerning and compassionate. You know, you look for the signs of possession, and sometimes there's some mental illness there also.
Got it. As the demons worn the person down in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
With that, we are going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. Pumpkin spice, southern pecan, apple pie, and maple French toast are just a few of the delicious fall coffee flavors from Grim Bean Coffee Company. With over 20 coffee options, Grim Bean has the perfect coffee for you. Let Grim Bean Coffee Company deliver artisan whole bean or ground coffee directly to you. Visit grimbeancoffee.com today for 10% off your order with the code BREADBOX at checkout. Experience the best with Grim Bean Coffee Company. Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Socks. Today we're here with Adam Bly, and we're talking about his book, Hauntings, Possessions, and Exorcisms, from Emmaus Group Publishing. And Adam, we just started getting into the weeds of this topic in the first section. And before we get too deep into our conversation, I think we need to stress that dealing with these cases of possession or instances where somebody thinks a demon is involved, this is not for amateurs. This is not something the average person should be delving into, is it?
Yeah, for sure. You know, you're talking about very serious situations, both spiritually and on a human level. I'm trying to think about the best way to describe this without sounding dramatic, but it is a very serious situation. You know, people can be so upset and worn down and terrified, they can be suicidal at times, which of course you need appropriate help for that. You would never eschew or avoid, you know, proper medical treatment if somebody's suicidal. But the demonic, you know, parlor tricks that go on can be very serious for the person. And there's a lot at stake. It's not something to be gotten into lightly. And the other big factor is that this work really needs to be done under a bishop's authority. And why is that? That is because the full authority Jesus gave to the apostles over demons. And the living apostles, of course, are the bishops that have inherited that authority, the full authority Jesus gave. And they delegate that authority to their exorcists. And that is what gives us the ability to demand the truth or obedience from the demons. If a person goes into a room with a possessed person and starts trying to boss around the demon or demand its name or demand information, and they don't have apostolic authority delegated to them, and because the church rules say only the exorcist should be speaking to the demon. So, you know, if you're in there and you don't have a bishop's authority and you're not the exorcist, you're doubly breaking rules. You go into that situation without that. Not only is the demon going to say, I don't have to listen to you, you have no authority over me, it's going to start testing you and trying to decide where your weak spots are and whether you can be destroyed. Because demons, by their very nature, seek to infect and taint and draw as many of us away from God as they can. And if you go into that room and they're in a body that can speak and look and reach out, touch you, and you go into that without, you know, that proper authority backing you up and an exorcist, you're vulnerable to that demon, you know, not necessarily possessing you, but starting to manipulate you. And these are cunning, really nasty creatures. And it's not the kind of thing you want to just play around with. You know, I mentioned this when this topic comes up, just as a cautionary note. We had somebody who many years ago went into a session as an assistant, just to gently restrain the person if necessary. And they went into it with mortal sin on themselves, so unconfessed. This was just a lay assistant. Okay. And the priest didn't know that. The person, you know, hid that. And they went into that situation, and because they were in it for the wrong reasons, they were in it for curiosity, and they went into it spiritually vulnerable in a state of mortal sin, the demon essentially got in their head and drove them mad, and they were institutionalized.
Wow.
So, and they've never been the same since. So, you know, that's an extreme example. I've also seen a person lock eyes with the demoniac, and stop breathing and not be able to breathe and having to break the gaze, by covering the demon's, you know, the person's eyes. So, I mean, there's different, you know, different things that, if you're vulnerable, if you're not in the right state and you're not there for the right reasons, not only are you not going to be effective, but they may try to destroy you too.
Right. And that walks right into the next question I had. And it's important, I think, for everybody to understand that, that these demons are definitely not bound to hell. They're out and about. They're seeking the ruin of souls. They're seeking opportunities to fulfill their mission. And that's an important thing to understand, because I think sometimes people just think this is all movie stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Scripture is clear about it. In Revelation, when it talks about the war in heaven, what does it say? You know, there was a war in heaven, and Michael and the good angels defeated the devil, and he was cast down to earth to roam here till the end of time. You know, in the Acts of the Apostles, it talks about, you know, he's the roaring lion that roams about the earth seeking who he can devour. And, you know, whenever he's cited in the Bible, you know, when he's in the book of Job, he's roaming around the earth, you know, accusing people to God. So, you know, he's allowed to do these things. His primary job is to tempt us. He does it because it's his nature. You know, it's like a rabid dog that bites you. He's diseased, and it's his nature, and that's what he's going to do. His heart is completely black and vicious, and he will strike if he can. So that's kind of, you know, his job. He's on a leash. He's allowed to tempt And if we invite him into our lives in an extraordinary way, you know, beyond just the falling to the regular temptations, but we get into some serious stuff, first commandment violations, turning to a spirit other than God for comfort, information, or power is what it boils down to. Then we have given him the rights to go to the throne and, of God and say, hey, I should be able to do extraordinary things to this person. They invited me into their life.
Right.
So, yeah, he's roaming around the earth. That's where the temptations come from, you know, the flesh, the world, the devil. And really, the world is tainted, what, from original sin? So it's from that original fall, the temptation to the snake in the garden. And he excites, you know, the passions in terms of the flesh. So, you know, those are all his normal jobs, but this, he's not in hell. It is a hell-like existence to be with him. That seems to be clear, but the lake of fire is used at the final judgment. It's a place prepared by God for the devil and the angels that follow him and the souls that'll be, you know, decided to be damned.
Mm-hmm.
That's not in use until the final judgment. So, you know, the idea of hell or Sheol is kind of, it's a little bit confusing because it's basically a Jewish idea of part of the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
That is there in Scripture. But the situation that we see described in terms of where he is and also the evidence we see from the cases is very clear. You know, he's roaming around. They keep tabs on us just like God keeps tabs on us. And he's doing what he can in the world.
Right. Now, something else I think we need to discuss, because, again, this is very important. We talked about it a little bit in the first segment about focusing on prevention rather than waiting for it to happen. And that is these demons and the devil, they're tricky. They're subtle how they work their way into the lives of their victims. And how do they go about doing this? Can you give us some examples you've seen, just not to sensationalize, but rather to give some advance warning, so to speak, for listeners?
Well, the biggest mainstream kind of, think of it as kind of a gateway drug analogy. You know, people might start by drinking a little and then they might drink heavier and then they might experiment with other stuff later.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest kind of gateway drug to getting into trouble, I think, right now is the ghost hunting and EVPs and spirit communication in some form. And then the reason I think that's the biggest right now is because it's popularized on TV.
Yes.
You know, 12 years ago, basically, you know, playing with Ouija boards and whatnot would be a quaint idea more from the late 1800s and the spiritualist stuff in 1910 or 1920. But, you know, now it's normal that everybody gets a flashlight and goes in grandma's attic and asks if there's a spirit there that wants to, you know, manifest to them because they see it on TV. And of course, if it's on TV, it must be the way to do things.
Right.
And so, so that's the biggest one. The most dangerous one is messing around with black magic in some form.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be because you are going beyond saying, hey, if there's a spirit out there, let's communicate somehow, whether it's a pendulum or, you know, rubbing a stone or throwing runes or Ouija boards or mediumship or whatever. That's one thing to say, hey, communicate. And that's bad because it's a First Commandment violation, because really what you're saying is comfort me about the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
Comfort me about a dead loved one, you know, give me information about the afterlife because I'm scared of mortality. Really, that's at the core of it. So that's the First Commandment violation. That's bad. But what's worse and much quicker is black magic. And essentially, the difference between magic and religion is religion, we follow God and we're submissive to God's will. All right, so it's thy will be done, right from the Lord's Prayer, right?
Right.
And the bottom line with magic is my will be done. So the approach of magic says if I get some special knowledge or information thing or a squiggly thing to draw on the floor or a way to wiggle my fingers or noises to make with my mouth, I can make the work, you know, get what I want in the world. I can get the girl, get the money, get the job, take revenge on my enemy, whatever it might be, whatever I want can be brought about. And that's really the bottom line of what the difference between magic and religion is. So, you know, we may pray and say, God, you know, if it's your will, you know, please grant us a baby. We're trying to have a baby or something. Not me. I'm not married. But, you know, many people would pray for that, but they would also accept God's will.
Right.
In terms of how God responds to that prayer, the black magic approach would be, you know, let's do the ritual that will, you know, force this to happen or ensure it'll happen. And so that goes beyond communication and says, I want to cut a deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, the bottom line is I want X and I'm willing to do Y to get it. You know, what's the payment here? Mm-hmm. Because you're turning to this spirit other than God and trying to cut a deal to get what you want. So, you know, the most common one is spirit communication. We see those cases on a regular basis. I'd say 20% of the cases we deal with, mostly houses and oppression, but it could lead to possession later, comes just from spirit communication because you've invited it to interact with you. So, yeah, that would be the biggest, most dangerous.
All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. I'm Pete Sox, the host of Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Head on over to my show page at breadboxmedia.com and support my show and our work here at Breadbox Media by becoming a premium member today. And we believe it's more about giving than receiving. When you become a premium member for just $9.99 a month, you unlock incredible discounts from our sponsors like Rugged Rosaries, Catholic Books Direct, Lifeboat Coffee, the Mass Box and the Harrisburg Senators, just to name a few. And it's even better. Every month, Breadbox Media chooses a nonprofit organization to partner with, and 10% of every premium membership is dedicated to that nonprofit. Join the revolution in Catholic media. Become a premium member by visiting my page today. A lot of ground here, Adam, and I have a couple questions that some of my followers have asked that I ask you. And the first of those was, how long have you been involved with this field, and how long have you had what some are considering a gift?
I've been involved. Our first conference we did was 2006, and I was involved for a couple years before that. So since about 2004, I've been involved in this to some degree. And in the first conference for exorcists that I was on a committee to organize, was 2006. So, you know, more than 10 years at this point. Okay. I think the idea of gifts, though of course God can give gifts and charisms and all of that, of course, I think the idea of them is really dangerous, particularly in this ministry, because it's a very kind of ego-centric and ego-encouraging idea that you're somehow special. I think that's really dangerous. I do think that God helps us out in this ministry. I've seen dramatic examples of that. Mm-hmm. But what I've seen is it's on a moment-by-moment basis when God wants to provide that assistance. It's not about any of us having a gift that we walk around with and we bonk a demon over the head with our gift because we decide to use it.
Gotcha.
We're trying to be obedient to our bishops and thereby serve God and God's church. And in the course of that, if God decides, you know, he's going to move in a particular way during an exorcism or a case he uses a person to do that, that's God. That's not us. So anyway, that's my way of framing it, mm-hmm. and saying, like, yes, extraordinary things do happen, but I don't like to talk about that because it builds on that illusion of specialness and gotcha. We're all just mortals, you know?
I think the humility you have in your field is something to commend, actually. Because again, like you say, that sort of builds you up a little if you're thinking what some people are.
Yeah, it's not humility though. That's just reality. It's not humility. It's not false humility. It's just, I think, seeing things for what they are. I mean, you know, we have a few years of life and we do some work during that time and then we're gone. And hopefully we make it to God, but Jesus was Jesus, and it's his living presence that is actually doing all of this work. He's really the exorcist. I've seen a number of times where Satan's been present in a body, the actual Satan, mm-hmm. and he talks to the tabernacle, and it's clear, though we don't hear Jesus talking back, it's clear that God is addressing him from the tabernacle. This happened again just a couple weeks ago. The living presence of Jesus is all around us, and he's doing all this work. He chooses to do it kind of through us in a way, through our prayers for each other, but it's really him doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think the more you can stay grounded in understanding that, the more effective you are, because the more you get out of the way of God and God's grace, I think the more the grace flows, because when you're humility and give all the honor and glory to God, I think that pleases God because that's reality.
Right. It's a very good point. Now, the next question is an interesting one. And when I started my ministry of reviewing books and whatnot, I had a Catholic author tell me that, I in essence had a target in my back because I was being evangelistic and spreading the news, and it's something the devil doesn't like. So the question here is, have you ever suffered any attacks from the devil because of the work you do?
Yeah. What typically happens for most people that get involved in this, at the solemn exorcism level, there's usually in the first year or two, there's usually a few parlor tricks and things done to try to wave you off, to try to see if you can be easily dissuaded from getting involved in this or staying involved. So, nobody gets hurt, nothing serious. They just try to see if they can, just scare you away, put on a little show and scare you away. So, I went through that, probably in the first year or two at the house that I was in at the time, and basically annoying stuff around the house. And then I had a good monk friend who came and blessed the house, and everything stopped. So yeah, there was a little bit of nonsense at the beginning, but that was many years ago at this point. Mm-hmm. And we do exorcisms every week. We do multiple exorcisms every week, and I've now met the same demons over and over in different cases in different parts of the world. The big name ones you encounter over and over through your career, and it gets to the point where you recognize them when they show up. It's like, oh, I think this is so-and-so. And it's I don't know, it's kind of odd. But after a while, it's like you're punching the clock and going to work and, yeah. You know, you stand at your assembly line and, and build your parts and then your shift is done. It almost has, there's a layer of it that kind of has that feel like it's no longer, the demons have long since realized that you're not skittish, you're not overly impressed, you're not scared. So they drop all of that dramatic Hollywood type scare tactics. Gotcha. And it becomes much more matter of fact and businesslike. Okay. So yeah, I mean, these days it's not like in the movies. They will put on a show like that and act dramatic if somebody new is there who they don't know yet whether they can rattle them. It's kind of like working in a prison. You've probably never worked in a prison, but I've worked in one as a psych for a number of years, a few different prisons. Okay. And the first time you go to the hole, this is a good analogy, actually. It may sound obtuse, but the first time you go to the hole, and if you're a new face, they put on a huge show. There's banging and screaming and just unbelievable noise and vulgarity. And they want to see if they can rattle you. And then once your reputation, if it's good, is established and people know you, you walk into the same place 6 weeks later, and it's just quiet. And you're walking down, and you just hear, "Hey, Mr. Bly," you know, as you walk past the door. And it's very, and it's civil. So, you know, it's kind of like that. Once they realize you're not fazed, it's much, much more matter of fact with, from them and from us. Gotcha. It's much more straightforward.
So what is your role in these exorcisms? And you alluded to the fact that you're not basically stationed in the United States, that you've gone multiple places. So what's your role and where all have you been to do this? Because this is obviously a big problem.
Well, I mean, you know, my formal role is by decree of my bishop. I'm a paratus, which is just a Latin word that means expert in religious demonology and exorcism. And that's a title that's normally given in ecumenical councils to somebody outside of the church that's going to provide consultation to the ecumenical council on whatever the topic is. It wouldn't necessarily be exorcism. It could be anything.
Okay.
And that was done because I was going to be educating priests. And since there's really no degrees in this, you could put together a committee if they're willing and maybe do an advanced degree of self-study, but there's no school to go to for this. So there had to be some way of recognizing and formalizing the knowledge and the authority to train priests. So I was, you know, made a paratus or an expert in the church on this topic by decree of my bishop. So my role basically is to kind of train priests, answer questions from all over the country when we get calls or emails, to go into exorcisms if somebody's new and they're relatively nearby in the diocese. Once the assistance and my bishop approves it, I'll be there for their first few actual solemn exorcisms, because you want somebody in the room that's experienced. You don't want everyone in the room. It's the first time they've seen this or done this. Because the demons just will, you know, put on a show and try to mess with them and confuse them and use their bag of tricks. And if you have somebody there who's seen 90% of their tricks, they can coach you through it. And they can say, "Hey, don't put up with this. Just order them to shut up, sit in the chair," and you know, a bunch of very practical things that somebody new wouldn't know. So I'm kind of a coach. I also teach at national conferences where, you know, we might have 80, 90, 100 priests from around the country. They come in for a few days and we give lectures and training on things. I might go to a diocese to a clergy day and speak to all the priests of the diocese. And that would be more about oppression, house cases, the basics of things, because they're not all exorcists, obviously, but a lot of bishops want to have all their priests educated on the basics and have them be able to handle, you know, the lesser situations that aren't possessions.
Right.
So it's kind of a mix of things.
Okay. Well, we're going to take one more quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back. The Catholic solution to the healthcare problem is here. Paying too much for your healthcare costs? Solidarity HealthShare is a healthcare sharing ministry which provides an ethical way to fund healthcare costs while protecting and practicing our Catholic beliefs. Best yet, Solidarity HealthShare's members are exempt from the fines and penalties in the Affordable Care Act. For more info, call 844-313-4999. Again, that's 844-313-4999, or visit SolidarityHealthShare.org. That's SolidarityHealthShare.org. Today with Adam Bly, the author of Hauntings, Possessions, and Exorcisms for Romance Group Publishing. We covered a lot of ground here, Adam, and one thing I wanted to say is you've done this work, you said, for 10 years. Has there ever been a scenario that made you think, why am I doing this?
No, there's never been like a moment that was so crazy or scary where I said, you know, why am I doing this? There's been surreal moments where you kind of feel like you're in a movie or something happens and you might say amongst yourselves, you know, the people that are there, like, you know, like, wow, if we tried to tell somebody what we just saw, you know, nobody would believe us. Mm. And there's moments like that where your life might be so surreal that evening that, you know, you kind of shake your head in wonder at the life you're leading. But you know, there's never been a, you know, what have I done? You know,
right.
I wish I could get out of this. There's never been a sense of that.
Do you find that it's in some sense rewarding? Like you're helping, carry through this mission, as you state, you know, Jesus is doing it through you. Is there any feeling of that at the end of the night?
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. I feel the most at peace in my life, when we're praying for people. I feel the most peace and the most sense of identity and kind of being settled with who I am. It feels like this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And again, there's no holiness on my part. There's mm-hmm. no specialness. I wrestle with the same sins everybody else wrestles with. So there's nothing special about me, but in those moments, you know, there's a sense of you've been given a gift to participate and watch miracles that are, you know, seven of the major gospel accounts that Jesus did were exorcisms. You're getting to watch, you know, a replay of gospel stories in front of you. So, you know, there's a great sense of being privileged to participate in something, you know, really, really wonderful. And yeah, when you see people freed, and that shift happens and you all know it, you know, that's a wonderful thing, you know, that soul has been kind of pulled back from the brink mm-hmm. from that suffering and that despair and freed by God. So, yeah, I mean, there's certainly those really good moments. But mostly it's just the consolation of you're doing the work you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's awesome. So one of the things I noticed, and it seems like for a long time, exorcism and this whole conversation of demonology was shrouded in secrecy, as if people didn't want to talk about it or it was a taboo subject to discuss. But lately it appears the church is more willing to talk about this subject. Is there a reason for this?
I think so. And I think that, you know, back in, I think it was 2011, the U.S. bishops had a special session on exorcism at their national conference. And it was written up in the New York Times, you know, because there's always reporters at the bishops' meetings. And one of the things they asked the bishop who had organized that special session was, you know, why are you guys having a special session on exorcism? Isn't, you know, and obviously in, the implied part of that is, like, isn't this just medieval nonsense? It isn't real. Why would you waste time, you know, talking about this? And, you know, their response at the time was, well, we've seen a lot of real cases in recent years, and we thought because of that, we need to talk about it. And that kind of is the bottom line. You know, I know many bishops, and they all kind of say a similar thing. And the, you know, experienced ones that have been bishops for many years or decades will say, you know, they used to get a few couple complaints a year. They would almost always turn out to be psychological. This wasn't something that was really needed or done. And then for whatever reason, in these last 10 years or so, there's been a dramatic increase in genuine cases. And not, you know, for that reason, but also because the popes have consistently said every diocese should have an exorcist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our current pope, of course, talks about the devil quite a bit and the reality of it, which isn't surprising because in South America, they're very open about this ministry and it goes on all the time. It's more the U.S. and Europe that had stopped for a while. So, yeah, the bottom line is the church has always said that this is real and necessary. It's more in the Western, you know, kind of Western European and the West, you know, the United States and Canada, really, where it fell away. It's continued in most of the other parts of the world. And now what we're seeing is the bishops in our part of the world are seeing more and more real cases to the point where it really can't be ignored. I mean, if you did ignore it, you'd be kind of disobeying what the popes have been telling us to do, and you would also be leaving souls suffering, which that wouldn't be good. But the bishops are not ignoring it, and what we're seeing is most dioceses have set up programs at this point.
So if someone's out there listening to you and I talk today and they feel this call to serve somehow in this ministry, first, can they? And second, how do they go about discussing this with someone? Who do they go to talk about it?
You know, at this kind of... All right, there's a qualitative difference between typical spiritual warfare, what you might see at charismatic prayer meetings or, you know, basically what would be typically called deliverance or spiritual warfare. There's a qualitative difference between that and solemn exorcism. Mm-hmm. And the church figured that out, you know, centuries ago, and that's why they separated it and put a lot of restrictions and made, you know, a canon law about it to regulate it, because it's a very different thing than just praying for somebody. When you're praying command prayers, which are sometimes called imprecatory, and some people argue about the meaning of imprecatory is actually that it involves a penalty or with it or a threat with the prayer, but really exorcism does, because it's that the demons suffer if they disobey the command. And that's kind of built into the prayer. So people sometimes miss that nuance when they hear us say imprecatory. They say, well, that means, you know, with a threat of punishment. But that is kind of implied in it. But anyway, when you get involved in bossing a demon around, you know, in the name of Jesus Christ, leave this person and stop bothering them, that's a qualitatively different thing. And you've entered into a direct spiritual conflict. If I say, Jesus, please help this person, I'm making a request to God, and then God may choose to bonk that demon on the nose and do something. Mm-hmm. If I say to the demon in the name of Jesus. Now, that wouldn't be me. Obviously, I'm not the exorcist. But if the exorcist says, in the name of Jesus Christ, leave this person alone and get out of here, he's now entered into a direct conflict with it. And he has consented by doing that into the spiritual struggle with that demon. And that's why you want to have the bishop's apostolic authority and therefore the church backing you up when you do that, so that you're not just a priest or a person entering into a struggle with a fallen angel, mm-hmm. spiritually or physically, because, you know, they're in a body and they can jump up and try to hit you or whatever. Right. But if you have authority, you can say, sit down and put your hands in your lap and be quiet till I tell you to tell me something. So it's a very different thing. And basically the bottom line, you know, that's a long-winded way to come around to, there really is not a way to get involved in this. You know, if your diocese has an exorcist, they no doubt have a very small team of people that they already knew and trusted. These are generally going to be adult, professional qualifications, doctors, nurses, lawyers, maybe just very pious people that that exorcist already knows well, that is going to be their team of people that do the interviews with the calls that come in, that go to the exorcisms and assist, that everybody sits around and talks about cases together. That's a very trusted small group of people, and it's not something that people rotate in and out of, or, you know, a student at the seminary wants to go to an exorcism, so we'll bring them over. It's not something that's entered into casually. Gotcha. It's a very serious responsibility. Like, if we take somebody into that room, we're kind of responsible for what happens to them. And if we made the wrong call about saying, yes, this person can be in the room, and then they get hurt or spiritually damaged and their life gets derailed, in a sense, that's on us, you know, at least emotionally and psychologically.
Right.
It's a big, big responsibility. So, you know, this is something that's, you know, the bishops pick some priests they know well and they trust, and that priest picks a few people they already know well and trust. So if you're feeling a call to this, you have to wait on Jesus and see if Jesus opens the doors for that to happen, because really God is the only one that can open those doors. You can't go to your diocese and say, I want to be involved in exorcism because I have a calling and you better listen to me. That's not going to get you anywhere. If anything, you're going to be definitely off the list of consideration because you're being pushy about it.
Right.
So, you know, this is, and the other thing is, you know, this is not an area that really you should want to get involved in, unless God calls you into it. And there's going to be evidence of that through your life circumstances already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people involved in this, they've been maneuvered into it slowly over time. Relationships have grown organically over time. It's not because they had, you know, an experience and now they feel called and they want to be admitted directly into the heart of it all. We get those, you know, those emails all the time. So, you know, if God calls you, the way is going to be opened by God. It's not something you're going to be able to do on your own.
Great answer. With that, we're out of time today. Adam, I'm going to give you a couple bit here to tell people where they can find your book, Hauntings, Possessions, and Exorcisms, and other work that you do.
So I'm not just trying to promote a book to make money so people understand that. I wrote this book because people asked me so many times over the years when I would speak to the public whether I had something written down and they wanted that. So I hope it's useful, and it was a response to people asking for it. But, you know, you can just go to Amazon or go to MAS Rhodes website, you know, punch in my name, Adam Bly, B-L-A-I, or, you know, the Hauntings, Possessions, and Exorcisms. And my website is religiousdemonology.com, and that's just an informational website with basically all the common questions that I get over the years, and kind of essays and kind of descriptions, maybe a little more complete than we've been able to do here.
Great. Adam, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule and spending it with us. Any closing thoughts?
No, I would just encourage anybody that's listening, learn about God's laws, be grateful grateful for life. Thank God, stay in close relationship with God, and don't worry about the demonic.
Good advice. And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time...